This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Welcome back. I'm your host, Christopher Rose, with the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. Today's episode is part two of my interview with Susan Douglas, doctoral candidate in world history from George Mason University, who has a long and impressive career in education, conducting workshops, and writing numerous publications, including the Indian Ocean in World History website at indianoceanhistory.org, and impressive resources for teachers and students on Indian Ocean trade. Here's part two. So we've mentioned a few times that the sort of model for trading in the Indian Ocean and on into Southeast and East Asia, there really was a game change when the Europeans arrived on the scene, which happened famously at the end of the 15th century. Can you talk a little more about what that entailed and what kind of changes took place?
Well, I think first there's a necessity to talk about what didn't take place. First of all, the Portuguese and their other European rivals didn't bring the Indian Ocean trade into being, nor at the beginning of their presence there did they sort of massively up the volume of trade, if for no other reason than that they didn't have a whole lot to bring into the trade that was going on in the Indian Ocean at the time. They didn't have spices, they didn't have silk, they didn't have, you know, they had wool, they had a few other things that came from Europe. But, of course, what attracted them and their royal sponsors were the luxury goods that were there in the Indian Ocean. So, A, they didn't bring the trade into being, and B, the second important point is that the Indian networks, ocean networks, didn't change, collapse, or, to put it in a funny way, roll over and play dead with the arrival of Vasco da Gama and his successors in the Indian Ocean. Rather, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, and later English and other merchants joined the direct trade for the first time and had to adjust themselves to the situation. So English traders even relied upon local capital at times to finance their trade. It was difficult, dangerous, distant, and daunting to be a factor, that is, an agent of one of these trading companies in a faraway land. Many of them died. Many of them went broke. You know, many of them got into all sorts of other trouble. But over time, you can say that there was an important change in the terms of trade, and there were changes in the effect of the globalization of trade. In other words, you know, the earth had been circumnavigated, and now various goods that were available through mining and colonization of the New World became available and changed things in the Indian Ocean environment.
Okay, so as you mentioned, these are things that didn't happen. What would you say were the more profound changes that did take place?
Well, as I mentioned before, the presence of wealth and power as a result of European discovery of the Americas changed some of the items that were available there and changed the terms of trade in terms of especially of the way that goods could be paid for by European merchants. And so over time, the accumulation of capital, in large part from the colonies that were producing gold and silver in the New World, in the hands of European trading companies, began to change the terms of trade by infusing a lot of precious metal into the trade that perhaps hadn't been a major factor. Barter and other types of exchange were probably more important before. So the trading companies were chartered, they possessed military power, they minted coins and issued paper, and monopolized trade for the mother country or the country that was chartering them. So this process, followed by European entrenchment and colonization, took centuries to alter the balance in favor of European merchants and political power. But you could say in the meantime, another important thing happened, and that was that the Europeans kind of began to do an apprenticeship in terms of the styles of things that were in demand in Europe, in terms of the certain commodities, learning how these things were grown, learning how the textiles were produced, that, for example, cotton prints, how were these dyes produced that didn't run, that you could print on cotton and have the colors not run together, the styles and designs of floral designs that go back millennia. One of the things that Europeans started to do was what we today when we talk about developing countries call import substitution. So they began to imitate some of these things and to adopt the techniques in manufacturing these things, or to find, you know, eventually in industrialization to find ways to do them, you know, with sort of in mechanized ways. So what you have there are crafts in the textile, ceramic, and other areas where Europeans served these apprenticeship to artisans in the regions, and by way of import substitution and sometimes harsh penalties against the entry of imports in Europe, industrialization transformed those crafts into mechanically produced goods, mass-produced more cheaply, and sold in competition with artisan-produced goods. By then, the mid-19th century military might had entrenched colonial powers, mainly the British, Dutch, and French, on the entire route to the Indian Ocean and within it. But as these goods, such as ceramics and textiles, they were two of the major ones, and of course spices as a commodity, became very popular in Europe, the demand increased exponentially for these goods, and then the merchants in Europe were trying to find ways to imitate them so as to have cheaper versions and versions that were not just for the elites, but then for middle classes and others. One other point that I might mention is in terms of the changes in goods that resulted from the globalization of trade, were that when we often teach about the Columbian Exchange, we talk about what came to Europe from the New World in terms of tomatoes and peppers and various things of that nature. And we sometimes teach also about things which came to the Americas, such as animals and so on, and grains. But we should also remember that because these trade routes in the Indian Ocean were so well established, the flow of Columbian Exchange goods from the New World was quite rapid in getting across those routes into places like China, so that the arrival of the potato in China already within 100 years was enhancing nutrition there and causing, you know, some population growth. You have another famous example where the Mughal emperor apparently ate and had his court paint a turkey before the first Thanksgiving in the Americas.
Wow.
Exactly. And this is one of the few things you could actually document that meal, because he had the painter paint this turkey before it went to the cooks in the kitchen.
And of course a lot of the silver that was being circulated in the Indian Ocean was coming out of the New World. It was being mined by the Spanish and taken directly to China across the Pacific, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. And some of it, of course, also came in the other direction, but that is a very important thing that world historians have recently discovered. One of the more famous quips by an economist, A.G. Frank, is that the Europeans bought a ticket on the Asian train with American silver. It kind of succinctly puts it in one statement.
Absolutely. So with all of this trade and the entry of the Europeans onto the scene, were there any other developments? So we've talked about social, we've talked about economic, but a lot of times this sort of trade also led to technological advances, sometimes even inadvertent ones. Do we see that here as well?
Well, you definitely do. And one of the things that took place while the world was still in the age of sail was, of course, the advancement of ships for use in long-distance travel across the oceans, across the open oceans. And for when you look at the change in the routes, of course, we have the circumnavigation of Africa is one of the main routes that is very obvious for changing. But with the discovery of the southern Indian Ocean routes. These are called the Roaring 40s and the Screaming 60s and so on. These are the lower degrees of latitude, or the higher rather, degrees of latitude toward the South Pole, where there were extremely strong winds, but where a ship could kind of hitch a ride on those routes and find themselves, you know, blown all the way almost to Australia, where they would then make a sharp left turn and go up to Java, unless they crashed into the coast, which somebody did and inadvertently discovered Australia. But these routes were dependent upon things like the longitudinal clock that could be used to plot longitude at sea. These are all entries that are there on the site for further explanation. But you have wonderful paintings of these fleets of ships you know, sailing, diving, crashing into the winds, you know, there and being blown across very quickly across these southern routes. So when you compare the routes from the earlier periods and ones that are still used throughout, all the way from ancient times through to today, the ones that hug sort of the northern rim of the Indian Ocean, now you have these others being used. And then, of course, with the end of the Age of Sail and the beginning of steam travel, which was still kind of a mixed affair at the very beginning of steam travel, they were able to use those routes, and they became then independent of the winds, or at least somewhat independent of the winds. And yet those routes had been opened up and have still been frequent because they enable a quicker sail across these vast distances.
So one of the other questions that pops up is the sort of human factor in all of this. Granted, it's been probably the better part of a decade since I was in East Africa, but there was a large resident South Asian population there, a lot of whom were affiliated with the merchant classes. Is that something that we see as the result of European colonialism, or is that something that's sort of always been?
I think the answer is both. You had in very early trade, even in pre-Islamic times, you had Yemenis traveling across, Southern Arabians, that is to say, traveling across the monsoon routes and taking up residence in areas of the coast where they did business. You had the famous Geniza documents that give evidence of Jewish trading families moving around in these areas. The famous book by Amitav Ghosh in An Antique Land, talking about the family relations that testified to these migrations and these, you know, temporary migrations and more permanent migrations around the area. As I said before, even Islam, you had Persian families settling on the East African coast. You have evidence of Hindus migrating into Southeast Asia and carrying Hinduism and all sorts of cultural and artistic influences there. This all really steps up with colonialism. When colonial powers, having multiple colonies, were able to sort of ship people around. And the most famous example is the one you mentioned of the coolies who were recruited from agricultural peoples in India and were brought to do projects and so on into East Africa and South Africa. Indeed, Gandhi is among the people who migrated through British colonialism, where he got his start in South Africa. In addition to that, there have been a number of studies lately that are interesting to go into on the prevalence of different types of slavery. Ibn Battuta, back in the 14th century, again mentioned the incredibly different ethnic groups that crewed the various ships, including Chinese ships would have had multiple ethnicities working as their crews. This continues all the way through into the period, whether those crews were impressed as slaves in part from one place or another. You had people landing on islands, and in the colonial period, again, plantations are set up, famous vanilla plantations set up on Réunion, for example, by the French, where vanilla from the New World began to be grown in the Indian Ocean for as a commodity. So you have all kinds of motion, and certainly it has continued into the modern period, but it certainly is a very long duration.
So as you mentioned, this trade's been going on for 90,000 years. What would you say are the lasting legacies of the Indian Ocean trade that we can still see?
I think one of them that struck me in doing the research for this project, which involved, you know, over 500 entries and all kinds of topics from the first golf ball to you know, the kind of materials that were used to sheathe transatlantic submarine cables and things like that. The lasting legacy, or a lasting legacy, of the tropical Indian Ocean is the vast number of goods, products, and styles that have informed global taste today. When you think of rubber, when you think of silk, when you think of any number, dyes of all kinds, these were the products that in their natural form were very much desirable, and which have been synthesized through chemistry into sort of imitations of their natural products that are very widely used today. So you can see a direct line to the discovery of these commodities, many of them, you know, as I said, natural items from this tropical paradise, so to speak, this huge, vast area, that have come into global trade, have become commodities, and have been made into synthetics nowadays. So I think that's a striking thing of the legacy of this ocean. And it's also important to remember that the trade has not ceased at all. It is a very active region today. It's one to which manufacturing has returned. And so some of the textile commodities that were first attractive to global trade are now being manufactured there, maybe under different auspices, under different terms of trade, like t-shirts and athletic goods and so on. But we shouldn't forget that those styles and those sort of perennial favorites in terms of colors and using plant designs and even the famous animal prints that you're seeing everywhere now come from that sort of tropical legacy of what is exotic and what is pleasing to the eye and so on. So I think that that it's important to continue to look at the region and not just focus on it as many curricula and teachers do, just in the medieval period. Like this is the time when we do the Indian Ocean. I think looking at it in that continuity from the very most ancient times of early human migration all the way to globalization is a very interesting exercise in seeing how things change and how things at the same time remain.
Excellent. And of course, I would highly encourage anyone who's listening who has an interest in this to check out the IndianOceanHistory.org website, because it really is an impressive resource with over 500 primary documents that illustrate all aspects of the Indian Ocean trade from pre-antiquity through to the present. Susan, it has been wonderful having you on 15 Minute History, and I'd like to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
All right. We'll see you next time. Don't forget, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find a transcript of this episode, along with supplemental documents, suggestions for further reading, and correlations to this Texas and National Educational Standards for History and Geography on our website, blogs.utexas.edu/15-minute-history. That's the numerals 15-minute-history. You can also find a link to suggest topics for upcoming episodes. The University of Texas at Austin is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in episodes of 15-Minute History do not represent the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.